Welcome. You're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials or items read on Ayers Allais are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Hello, this is Roger Baker, and welcome to this podcast of articles from Sky and Telescope, brought to you by Ayers Allais. Today's articles are from the March 2025 edition. In today's podcast, we'll be taking a look at News Notes, which are various news articles from the world of astronomy. Next, a Martian polar expedition. Watch spring unfold in the red planet's Arctic. Written by Thomas A. Dobbins. Next, a long-awaited lunar eclipse. This month, Earth's umbral shadow covers the moon for the first time since 2022. Written by Bob King. Next, Tsuchinshan Atlas shines. Comet C-2023-A3 put on a fine display for observers worldwide. Written by Sean Walker. Next, Seeing Beyond the Blue. The distant ice giant Neptune is a kaleidoscope of cloud activity. Written by Heidi B. Hamill. Next, What is Twilight? Written by Gary Saronic. And finally, It's Time for Africa. Africa hosted the International Astronomical Union's General Assembly for the first time in August 2024. Written by Govert Schilling. And now, on to today's podcast from Sky and Telescope. News Notes. Telescope. Arecibo's powerful radar may have contributed to the telescope's demise. The radar system at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico was once the most powerful source of electromagnetic radiation on this planet, enabling the mapping of Venus, the Moon, and near-Earth asteroids. Then, in 2020, support cables for the Giant Dishes observing platform failed, resulting in the collapse and permanent closing of the storied telescope. Now, an inquiry has found those very radar transmissions may have helped trigger the collapse. Arecibo consisted of a 1,000-foot-wide dish mounted over a natural sinkhole. Three concrete towers suspended a 900-ton receiver and transmitter platform above the dish. To hold the radar platform's support cables in place, molten zinc was poured into tapered steel sockets, a standard method used for well over 100 years in a variety of industrial settings. Yet, a committee formed by the National Academy of Sciences and sponsored by the National Science Foundation concludes that those zinc sockets might have weakened unexpectedly in a phenomenon called zinc creep. The raging winds of Hurricane Maria in 2017 provided additional stress that ultimately led to the telescope's demise. Initially, the collapse made little sense. As far as we know, there is no recorded case of a cable that has stood the initial loading and then, over time, pulls out at loads that are lower than the initial level, says Habib Tabatabai, a civil engineer who served on the committee. The pattern of cable pullouts were also puzzling, he notes. The cables pulled out more at the tower level than at the platform, and some newer cables failed before older ones did. That pattern didn't match weakening from hurricane winds alone. After some digging, the team found a 1963 study that documented zinc creep when high currents were applied over a short period of time, such as during manufacturing processes. But the panel realized that if currents had been induced that were orders of magnitude lower but sustained over longer periods, the same effect could occur. The likely source of those currents? The telescope's powerful S-band planetary radar system added to the facility in 1997. Its emissions could have induced surface currents in the steel cables that would have flowed through the sockets, weakening the zinc there. While this scenario isn't proven, Tabatabai cautions it would explain why the cables on the towers, within the beam of the radar emissions, were the ones most affected. While the phenomenon was unanticipated, the report nevertheless notes that clear danger signs were missed. After Hurricane Maria, inspections showed that cables were pulling out of their sockets by more than an inch. Major steps should have been taken to improve the supports at that time, and a much more rigorous program of inspections and maintenance should have been in place for such an important facility. We hope that our report can at least shed some light on what happened, Tabatabai says, and guide the way for the future. Solar System. Sources of most meteorites identified. Two teams publishing in the October 17th Nature have traced 70% of meteorite falls to specific collisions in the main asteroid belt. The origins of even the most common meteorites, known as H-chondrites and L-chondrites, which together make up some 70% of meteorite falls, has long remained elusive. To track down their sources, a team led by Miroslav Bras gathered data on major main belt asteroid families, members that were once part of a larger body. After a collision splits a body apart, the fragments' initially similar orbits spread out over time. The researchers simulated the evolution of those orbital motions, including the effects of exposure to solar heating, cosmic rays, gravity, and other forces. Bras's team found that H and L chondrite meteorites originate primarily from three families produced in recent collisions. Two of these occurred 7.6 million and 5.8 million years ago, respectively, and a third happened within the last 40 million years. In an accompanying study in the same issue of Nature, a group led by Michelle Marset traced an additional source of L-chondrite meteorites back to a collision that occurred some 470 million years ago. That one might even have left Earth with a ring of debris. The more ancient event might have supplied almost all of the meteorites at that time and still provides some 20% of falls. The models are very elegant and manage to explain several key observables with a single model, says Mikhail Granvik, who was not involved in the research. I think that it is a great feat and one that will push the field forward by a great leap. The details still need to be worked out, though, he adds. It will be very interesting to see how tests of their hypotheses will play out in the years to come. Black holes. Newfound stellar companion may explain black hole system. The system V404 Cygni is an old favorite. Its 9 solar mass black hole is slurping gas from a nearby star slightly less massive than the Sun. The hot swirling gas creates an X-ray beacon, making this system a canonical low-mass X-ray binary. Here, low-mass refers to the companion star. But it turns out the binary at the heart of V404 Cygni isn't alone. Even back in the early 1990s, astronomers noticed another star almost on top of the binary as seen from our perspective, though they generally assumed it to be an interloper. But as Kevin Burge and colleagues report in the November 14th Nature, this star is part of the V404 Cygni system after all. The team determined from a suite of observations that the star moves through space with the binary and has probably been part of the system from the get-go. The tertiary star is a shirt-tail relation, however. It lies more than 3,500 astronomical units from the inner binary, or roughly 90 times farther out than Pluto lies from the Sun. Its current distance may help astronomers clinch how a black hole can form while still somehow retaining a small stellar companion in a tight orbit. In 2016, Smadar Noaz and her colleagues suggested that a third distant companion star could play a role in these systems' formation. The distant star's gravitational interactions with the inner binary, as well as the evolution of the star that will soon become a black hole, would create a complex interplay of changes that would ultimately lead the inner binary's orbit to shrink dramatically. The tertiary's orbit in V404 Cygni matches what Noaz's team predicted. I'm very excited by this discovery, she says. She's now collaborating with Burge to investigate the system's history in more detail. Curiously, the black hole seems to have had a quiet death. For V404 Cygni's tertiary to hang on to the inner binary, the black hole must have formed without the messy violence expected to send it reeling. The star might even have imploded without fanfare. Black hole eats one star, remains pummel a second. In 2019, a supermassive black hole began to eat a star. Although the resulting flare of light occurred some 210 million light-years away, it was bright enough that the Zwicky Transient Facility in California caught the event, dubbing it AT2019QIZ. But this wasn't an ordinary stellar feast. Although the black hole had already spaghettified the star in 2019, it took time for that noodle of gas to slip into the maw. It wasn't until 2023 that astronomers turned the Chandra X-ray Observatory to witness the high energy emissions from the long-term meal. That's when they found an unexpected spike in X-rays. Follow-up observations with other space observatories found 9 X-ray bursts, recurring roughly every 2 days. Matt Nichol and colleagues published the results in the October 24th Nature. Such quasi-periodic emissions have been observed elsewhere, but astronomers don't know why they happen. Nichol's team thinks the bursts come from something crossing the gaseous disk that now surrounds the black hole, another star. We don't expect many stars orbiting this close to a black hole, admits Nichol. We think that most of the stars are sitting much farther away, but every now and again they can deflect each other towards the black hole. If a single star fell toward a black hole, the strong gravitational field would shred the star to pieces. But if a stellar pair falls in, three-body gravitational interactions could enable the black hole to capture one of the stars in a stable orbit. These captures are rare, Nichol notes, but once bound to the black hole, the star's orbit decays only slowly. At any given time, a black hole at the center of an average galaxy will have about one star in a tight orbit like this. Then, if another star by chance falls into the black hole, its material spreads out into a disk and begins to interact with the captured star. However, this is just our simple picture, Nichol cautions. Now that we think we know what to look for, we can observe what fraction of tidal disruption events have quasi-periodic oscillations, and this will let us actually measure how common these close-orbiting stars really are to test this theory. Stars. Astronomers map dandelion supernova. Astronomers have mapped the 3D structure of a famous dandelion-shaped supernova remnant. The map shows the explosion's debris is still speeding outward at more than 1,000 kilometers per second, or 2 million miles per hour, almost a millennium after the star at the center of it all detonated. In AD 1181, Chinese and Japanese astronomers recorded the arrival of a guest star in the constellation Cassiopeia, but it wasn't until 2013 that amateur astronomer Dana Patchak found the explosion's remnant in archived images from NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. Now we know that the object, named PA30, is the remnant of a Type 1AX supernova triggered by the explosion of a white dwarf star. The X denotes the fact that some of the star survived the ordeal. After a group of astronomers discovered filaments within PA30 in 2023, a team led by Tim Cunningham and Delaria Chiazzo mapped the structure in 3D using the Keck Cosmic Web Imager at the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii. Within the image of PA30, every individual pixel carries its own spectrum, from which the team could calculate the motions of the gas at that spot. The analysis is published in the November 1st Astrophysical Journal Letters. We find the material in the filaments is expanding ballistically. This means that the material has not been slowed down nor sped up since the explosion, says Cunningham. From the measured velocities, looking back in time, you can pinpoint the explosion to almost exactly the year 1181. The analysis reveals an unexpected asymmetry to the explosion that hints at an unusual origin. The data also reveal a large cavity inside the spindles. A reverse shockwave, traveling more slowly than the initial blast, may have cleared out the central space. Giorgio Dimitriadis, who was not involved in the research, says the detailed mapping of the most extreme supernovae, such as PA30, might shed light on more typical Type 1A supernovae. Solar System. Oldest and largest impact crater found on Venus. Scientists have found what might be the oldest and largest crater on Venus, and it's like none ever seen on our sister planet. Radar has previously enabled scientists to identify some 1,000 impact craters on Venus's surface. Dating only as far back as 1 billion years, and with sizes of at most 300 kilometers or 190 miles across, they're far younger and smaller than craters found on the Moon, Mercury, and Mars. Those worlds still have records of impacts from the solar system's first 2.5 billion years, when large chunks of planet-forming material still roamed around. Now, a new discovery published in the October Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets, might record an earlier impact on Venus. Vicky Hansen found the possible crater while mapping the oldest and most highly disrupted type of terrain on Venus, tesserae. The team was surprised that one of these regions, the Hatzibad Tessera, contains a circular, multi-ringed structure 1,500 kilometers wide. The beautiful concentric structures were very different from the rest of the tesserae, Hansen says. When Hansen and fellow mapper Ivan Lopez went looking for solar system analogs to help explain the ring's origins, they had to go as far afield as the icy moons of Jupiter. Callisto's Valhalla crater and Europa's Tyr crater both sport multiple rings, probably formed after something big punched through an icy shell floating on liquid water. While Venus wouldn't have had water, it did have lava. Team member Evan Bjorn used computer simulations to show that a single large object hitting a crust a few kilometers thick could have melted the underlying layer, leaving a thin crust over a hot lava pond. A second impact hitting the same spot could have then splattered ejecta in multi-ringed fashion. The lava pond likely remained hot for millions of years, making a double impact scenario less unlikely. Venus researcher Anna Gulcher says she is quite excited about the new insight the impact scenario offers for Tesserae. Understanding this odd terrain type unique to Venus has become one of the highest priorities for future missions to this planet, and studies like this one lay the groundwork for explaining its origin. In brief, radio burst from a dead galaxy. For the first time ever, astronomers have detected a fast radio burst, or FRB, in a large elliptical galaxy. The discovery, announced by Tarana Eftekhari at a conference in Khao Lak, Thailand, supports earlier indications that there are various ways to form the extreme objects that produce these ultra-brief flashes of radio waves. Most FRBs for which accurate sky positions are known can be traced to galaxies with a high rate of star formation. That's one of the reasons why scientists think that the bursts occur on magnetars, young and strongly magnetized neutron stars left behind when massive stars end their short lives in supernova explosions. However, FRB 2024-0209A doesn't fit this picture. Between February and July, the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME, radio observatory detected 22 bursts. Thanks to the repeated bursts and the recent addition of a small outrigger telescope, CHIME pinpointed the burst's origins to the outskirts of an old, massive, and luminous elliptical galaxy, almost 2 billion light-years away that doesn't show any signs of recent star formation. If FRB 2024-0209A occurred on a magnetar, the object may have resulted from some other process than a core-collapsing supernova. New views of Vega's dusty disk. Astronomers have used the Hubble and James Webb Space Telescopes to gain an unprecedented view of the vast disk of gas and dust surrounding the star Vega, and it's exceedingly smooth. Skylar Wolf led an effort using Hubble to peer at the outer, cooler part of the disk, where small, smoke-sized particles glint in Vega's light. Meanwhile, team member Kate Sue led an accompanying analysis of Webb data, revealing sand-sized particles in the hotter, inner part of the disk. The disk's smooth gradient is marred only by a subtle gap located about twice as far from Vega as Neptune circles the Sun. The results will appear in the Astrophysical Journal. While other stars' disks exhibit distinct gaps that might have been cleared out by giant planets, the absence of such planets around Vega could explain its disk's smoothness. According to René Oiedemeyer, who wasn't involved in these studies, it is becoming more established that more massive stars are less likely to be accompanied by planets than lower-mass stars, such as our Sun. Or, if Vega does have planets, they might be smaller than these new observations can pick up. The data can only rule out planets bigger than Neptune in large orbits. A Martian Polar Expedition. Watch spring unfold in the red planet's Arctic. Written by Thomas A. Dobbins. The north pole of Mars is tilted earthward during the current apparition, providing observers with an excellent vantage point to watch the retreat of the north polar cap as spring unfolds in the red planet's northern hemisphere. Although the apparent size of the Martian disk won't exceed 14.6 arcseconds, in 2025, the planet achieves a high altitude above the horizon that will compensate to some degree for its small size. With an axial tilt only slightly greater than Earth's, Mars experiences similar seasons to our home world. However, Martian seasons are nearly twice as long as Earth's because the length of a year on Mars is 687 terrestrial days. To mark the passage of the seasons during a Martian year, planetary scientists use solar longitude, often abbreviated as LS. At vernal equinox, the beginning of northern spring, LS is 0 degrees, it's 90 degrees at summer solstice, 180 degrees at autumnal equinox, and 270 degrees at winter solstice. Vernal equinox in the northern hemisphere of Mars occurred on November 12, 2024, so spring was well underway at closest approach to Earth in January. Summer solstice occurs on May 29 this year, when the receding planet's apparent diameter shrinks to a paltry 5.6 arcseconds. Axial tilt accounts for nearly all the seasonal changes we experience because Earth's orbit is nearly circular. But Mars has the highest orbital eccentricity of any planet except Mercury. During one Martian year, the planet's distance from the Sun varies from 249 million kilometers or 150 million miles at aphelion to 206 million kilometers at perihelion. These distance extremes correspond to a difference of almost 30% in the intensity of solar heating, giving rise to seasonal changes that are far more pronounced than Earth's. There's a considerable disparity in the size of the north and south polar caps of Mars caused by the eccentricity of its orbit. The climate in the planet's northern hemisphere is less extreme than in its southern hemisphere, with a smaller annual temperature range. The larger southern cap grows during the 382 terrestrial day-long southern hemisphere autumn and winter, when Mars is near aphelion and typically extends down to 50 degrees latitude by late winter. Conversely, the northern cap grows during the shorter, warmer 305 terrestrial days of northern autumn and winter, when Mars is near perihelion, so it seldom exists below 60 degrees latitude at its maximum extent. The North Polar Cap's permanent core persists into late summer and consists primarily of water ice. This remnant contains an estimated 1.6 million cubic kilometers of water ice, equivalent to about 30% of the Greenland ice sheet, and extends from the pole to about 80 degrees latitude. During winter, carbon dioxide, the principal constituent of the Martian atmosphere, freezes into a layer of frost and snow less than a meter thick atop the permanent cap of water ice. This seasonal veneer of frozen carbon dioxide contains more than one-eighth of the mass of the tenuous Martian atmosphere. The dry ice snow component also contains water ice crystals and particles of dust that act as condensation nuclei. As the carbon dioxide snow sublimates, it entrains considerable amounts of water vapor. The volatiles released by the retreating polar cap cause clouds and haze to form more frequently at low latitudes. Extensive haze on the morning and evening limbs of Mars should have begun to appear in February, as well as discrete white clouds over topographic elevations like the Tharsis Shield volcanoes and Libia Montes. The visibility of these features is greatly enhanced through blue, Raten 38A, and violet, Raten 47, eyepiece filters. As northern hemisphere spring arrives, longer hours of sunlight rapidly warm the Arctic regions, and the dense wintry canopy of clouds and ice fogs known as the polar hood begins to dissipate. But this year, the orbital motion of Mars is also causing the planet's distance from the Sun to increase throughout early spring. Mars will reach aphelion on April 1st, when LS is 70 degrees. As a result, for several weeks, the polar hood may reform, and the polar cap's retreat may slow or even reverse. Best remembered for his discovery of Pluto, Clyde Tombaugh was also an avid Mars observer. He coined the term aphelic chill for this recurring phenomenon. The retreating polar cap is often bordered by a narrow, dark collar known as Lowell's Band. Best seen through orange, Raten 21, and red, Raten 23 or 25 filters, this feature was first recorded by William Beer and Johann Heinrich Mädler during the 1930s. In the closing years of the 19th century, Percival Lowell imagined that it was a temporary sea of meltwater from the thawing polar cap that fed a global network of irrigation canals. Spacecraft images have revealed this transient collar as dusky fields of dunes swept clean of frost and snow by winds blowing off the pole. The Mars we know today isn't as captivating as Lowell's romantic version of the home of a struggling race of canal builders, but changes on the red planet remain enticing targets for backyard telescopes. Contributing editor Tom Dobbins is co-author of Epic Moon, A History of Lunar Exploration in the Age of the Telescope, available at shopatsky.com. A long-awaited lunar eclipse. This month, Earth's umbral shadow covers the Moon for the first time since 2022. Written by Bob King. Like hands and feet, eclipses come in pairs. During the month of March, we'll experience a total lunar eclipse followed by a partial solar eclipse. Both are visible in North America, although the latter will be limited to a few locations along the East Coast. The Moon's orbit is tilted by about 5 degrees to the ecliptic, the plane of Earth's orbit around the Sun. As the Moon revolves around our planet, it alternately dips above and below that plane, intersecting it at two points called nodes. For a lunar eclipse to occur, the moon must be full at the same time it crosses a node. When these circumstances are met, the sun, earth, and moon neatly line up in that order, and the moon passes through our planet's shadow as it does on the night of March 13th and 14th. At new moon, 2 weeks later, it cuts through that plane again, but this time it passes between the earth and sun, generating a solar eclipse. Observers across the Americas have the best seats in the house for the lunar eclipse. All 50 U.S. states will see the entire event, though western Alaska and Hawaii miss the start of the penumbral phase. The partial eclipse begins at 1:09 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on March 14th, with totality lasting from 2:26 a.m. to 3:32 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Mid-eclipse occurs at 2:59 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. From the West Coast, the partial phase begins at 10:09 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time on the 13th, with mid-eclipse occurring almost exactly at midnight at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Western European observers will see the totally eclipsed moon setting in the morning twilight, while on the other side of the world, New Zealanders get to watch the moon rise totally eclipsed. This won't be a particularly deep eclipse because the entire lunar disk misses the center of Earth's umbral shadow. During totality, we should expect to see the northern portion of the moon glow brighter than the southern due to the former's proximity to the umbral shadow's northern edge. En route to the umbra, the moon passes through Earth's outer shadow, called the penumbra. Here, sunlight and shadow mix to produce a filmy gray shading across the lunar disk. Watch for the penumbral shadow to become noticeable along the southeastern sky direction portion of the lunar disk, starting around 4:30 Universal Time. During the September 2024 partial lunar eclipse, the penumbra was much more obvious on my camera's live view screen compared to what my eyes saw. I recommend this approach as a good way to monitor the moon's progress during the event's early phases. The umbra takes its first nibble of the moon at 5:09 Universal Time, the start of partial eclipse. Well before totality, attentive observers will notice the shadowed portion of the lunar disk growing smoky red from sunlight refracted by Earth's atmosphere. Excitement mounts as totality approaches. When the last sunlit sliver of moon is swallowed by the umbra at 6:26 Universal Time, you can almost imagine a chorus of wows rising skyward from eclipse watchers. During the eclipse, the moon is relatively far from Earth and just a few days shy of apogee, which occurs on March 17th. As a result, the smallish lunar disk spends a generous 66 minutes crossing the northern portion of the umbra. Absent direct sunlight, the eclipsed orb always looks small and subdued to my eye compared to the boisterous brilliance of the full moon. The eerie darkness that descends over the landscape during totality further adds to the contemplative mood of this leisurely paced show. Dedicated observers use the 5-point Danyan scale, in which 0 is darkest and 4 is lightest, to estimate the brightness and color of the eclipsed moon, qualities linked to the clarity of Earth's atmosphere. Major volcanic eruptions can pollute the air with aerosols that strongly darken the moon. Photographing a lunar eclipse is straightforward. Indeed, with the capabilities of modern DSLR and mirrorless cameras, you hardly need a tripod for the partial phases. But a sturdy support is essential when the moon dwindles to a crescent, and especially during totality when exposures are longer. A tracking mount ensures good photos during all phases, particularly with longer lenses. While a smartphone works for handheld shots, most devices render the lunar disk disappointingly small. Instead, set up a telescope and either hold your phone lens up to the eyepiece or purchase an adapter to attach it directly. This effocal method yields screen-filling images you'll be eager to share on social media. You can also use a telescope on a tracking mount to shoot a close-up video of the eclipse to see if you can capture flashes from meteoroids striking the lunar surface. If you own a smart telescope, put it to work creating a time-lapse or video while you sit back and watch the event unfold with binoculars or a second scope. Sky and Telescope senior contributing editor Roger Sennett encourages observers to record the times when specific craters enter and exit the umbral shadow. The umbra is larger than pure geometry predicts because of atmospheric effects, which vary from eclipse to eclipse. On eclipse night, you'll want to bundle up warmly. Even in early spring, temperatures in some regions may drop below freezing late at night. But imagine what it's like on the moon's surface as Earth blocks the light and heat from the sun. During the May 2022 total solar eclipse, the thermal infrared sensor instruments on the Landsat 8 and 9 satellites recorded rapidly plummeting temperatures on the moon as it slid into the Earth's shadow. The temperature dropped from a toasty 97 degrees C, or 207 degrees Fahrenheit, down to minus 93 degrees Celsius. The data also revealed that different features cooled at different rates. Craters tended to hold onto their heat longer than their surroundings. After mid-eclipse, at 6:59 Universal Time, The moon slowly drifts out of the umbra and back into sunlight starting at 7:32 Universal Time. The event concludes when the moon exits Earth's penumbral shadow at 10:02 Universal Time. From beginning to end, the eclipse lasts 366 minutes. The next one occurs on September 7th, when the moon puts on a similar show, but for the opposite side of the planet. Before we go on, you're listening to a recording for the Blind and Print Impaired. Material or items read on Ayers & Lane are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Tsuchinshan Atlas shines. Comet C-2023-A3 put on a fine display for observers worldwide. Written by Sean Walker. The year's most highly anticipated comet did not disappoint. That's the consensus among observers after Comet Tsuchinshan Atlas, C-2023-A3, blazed forth before and after perihelion this past September and October. Tsuchinshan Atlas was first spotted as an 18.7 magnitude object at China's Purple Mountain Observatory, Tsuchinshan, according to transliteration, on January 9, 2023, and reported to the Minor Planet Center, though no follow-up observations were made by the observatory to confirm its position or identity. More than a month later, the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System, ATLAS, swept up an 18.1 magnitude object on February 22 at the Sutherland Observatory in South Africa. Preliminary orbital calculations determined it was the previously reported object and therefore was named for both Discovery observatories. A search of earlier images taken along the orbital path by other facilities yielded images taken with the Zwicky Transient Facility at Palomar Observatory in California, which showed the object. The deep exposures revealed its cometary nature. Orbital calculations determined it to be a non-periodic comet on its first trip to the inner solar system, resulting in the designation C-2023-A3. Observers with large telescopes monitored the icy snowball as it crept ever closer to the sun during 2023. Through August of 2024, the comet's brightness was trending upward, following predictions, and Tsuchinshan Atlas may have been even slightly brighter, according to some reports. At the time, it sported a short dusty tail and slightly longer ion tail. The morning display. By late September, Northern Hemisphere observers with unobstructed eastern horizons at dawn were treated to glimpses of the comet's brightening coma. The best views, however, were had by those located south of the equator, where, at perihelion on September 27th, the comet's long thin dust tail stood straight up from the horizon, spanning some 15 degrees or so. Viewing geometry meant that the dust and ion tails overlapped, though impacts from the solar wind caused kinks in the ion tail on a few occasions. By the start of October, it was clear that the comet had survived its 58.6 million kilometer, or 36 million mile, encounter with the sun. By this time, Tsuchinshan Atlas had brightened to about first magnitude. It continued to brighten as it moved between Earth and the sun, but was briefly lost in the solar glare. On October 7th, the comet brightened further due to forward scattering, as recorded by the SOHO spacecraft's LASCO C3 coronagraph. Astronomers estimate the coma achieved an impressive magnitude, -4.9, making it the brightest comet since Comet McNaught, C2006P1, which put on a fantastic display in early 2007. Some adventurous observers were able to image Tsuchinshan Atlas in broad daylight, though it was a challenge as it was so close to the sun. As it transitioned from a morning to evening object on October 9th, its bright dust tail flipped, as seen from Earth. The tail was so long that it took more than a week for the entire comet to pass through the SOHO spacecraft's LASCO C3 field. Sky and Telescope contributing editor Bob King noted, the combination dust and anti-tail extended for at least 50 degrees. The main event. Tsuchinshan Atlas made its closest approach to Earth on October 12th, when it slipped by at a distance of 70 million kilometers. Within days, it slowly climbed higher above the horizon, displaying a bright, straight dust tail more than a dozen degrees long. The comet was easy to spot in evening twilight, with a long, thin anti-tail of dust trailing behind it. This feature was most pronounced on the 15th, when Earth crossed the comet's orbital plane, and remained visible for roughly a week, despite the waxing moon brightening the evening sky. I was easily able to spot the dust tail spanning some 6 degrees on the night of the full moon on the 17th. By October 20th, the moon had departed the scene, allowing for a good look at the extended tail and slightly diminished anti-tail. Although the comet had dimmed to about fourth magnitude, its tail appeared about 10 degrees long and displayed almost twice that length in photographs. The comet faded by about a magnitude each night as it sped away and was lost to the naked eye from my moderately light-polluted backyard by October 25th, though remained an impressive object in binoculars and small telescopes. Telescopically, the inner coma of Tsuchinshan Atlas displayed interesting details after perihelion. Due to its low altitude, in the evening sky following closest approach, the false nucleus appeared slightly orange for several days. The view through mid-sized instruments with magnification of 100 times or more revealed several hoods of material in the inner coma. Japanese imager Shinichi Watanabe recorded several jets in the inner coma throughout October, using a Larsen-Sekanina filter, which removes circular structures from an image to better highlight other details. In early November, the moon returned to the evening sky, challenging the fading comet's visibility as it blended into the star fields of the Milky Way in Ophiuchus. So, was Tsuchinshan Atlas a great comet? Although it achieved a peak magnitude about as bright as Venus, it did so when it was close to the Sun and hardest to observe. When it was well placed for observers, it was about magnitude 1 or fainter. Still impressive. That's brighter than NEOWISE, see 2020 F3 in 2020. But most comet aficionados agree Tsuchinshan Atlas wasn't a great comet, and some still debate that title being bestowed on NEOWISE. Still, it put on a wonderful display, and for that, we are thankful. At press time, the Tsuchinshan Atlas show wasn't completely over, but by the time you receive this issue, the comet will be a fading telescopic object well on its way back to the outer solar system. Nevertheless, its brief display will be remembered for a long time. Associate editor Sean Walker has enjoyed observing comets since witnessing Halley's Comet with his mother 39 years ago. Seeing beyond the blue. The distant ice giant Neptune is a kaleidoscope of cloud activity. Written by Heidi B. Hamill. Neptune is a lovely, lonely world. At the planet's vast distance past Uranus, Neptune lies 30 times farther from the Sun than Earth does and takes 165 years to complete a single orbit. High noon is as bright as our twilight. Yet that faint sunlight illuminates a planet surprisingly rich with activity. Over the last several decades, Neptune has changed its appearance like an actor switching costumes between scenes. Festoons of white, puffy clouds come and go. Strange and short-lived dark spots develop and dissipate, all potentially driven by the very sun that lies so far away. We've pieced together this view thanks to a variety of observations. Only one spacecraft has ever drawn near Neptune, NASA's Voyager 2, which zipped by in 1989. In the decades since, my colleagues and I have continued to explore Neptune's clouds using increasingly powerful telescopes here on Earth and in near-Earth space. We can even see the distant planet's weather change. Yet, although our knowledge has increased, Neptune keeps its secrets well due to its dimness and its small apparent size as seen from Earth, just 2.3 arcseconds in diameter. Our knowledge of Neptune's clouds, therefore, remains comparatively thin. However, every year we use new telescopes, new detectors, and new analysis techniques to grasp for more understanding. Here's some of what we know and what is left to learn. The ice giants. We call Neptune and its fraternal twin, Uranus, ice giants, to differentiate them from their gas giant cousins, Jupiter and Saturn. We know from their shapes and gravitational fields, measured by Voyager 2, that the ice giants' atmospheres and interiors differ from those of their larger cousins. Jupiter and Saturn are primarily composed of hydrogen, with some helium and other things mixed in. Their cores are surrounded by a thick mantle of metallic hydrogen, a fluid phase that hydrogen adopts under very high pressure. Above this mantle lies an envelope of molecular hydrogen. Neptune also has a small, rocky core, but we think Neptune's thick mantle is made of a briny mixture of water, methane, and perhaps other hydrocarbons. This mantle may take up some 80% of the planet's mass. Overlying the briny layer is an atmosphere consisting primarily of hydrogen and some helium, perhaps up to 10% of the total mass, along with gases that condense to create myriad discrete clouds and banded structure. This is the atmosphere we see at wavelengths visible to the human eye. Whether the boundaries between the atmosphere, mantle, and core are sharp, like the boundary between oil and water, or more gradual, remains unknown. We don't have enough observations to accurately model Neptune's interior structure with high confidence. methane clouds, and layers of haze. Let's consider the atmosphere that we see, the global layer of pale blue clouds that serves as the background to bright white storms, dark spots, and banded structure. One of the most common misconceptions about Neptune's atmosphere is that its color is a deep azure blue. This misunderstanding resulted from the Voyager 2 images, which were processed to enhance the visibility of fainter clouds and banded structure. In fact, Neptune's true color is closer to a pale aquamarine. This color results when sunlight scatters off Neptune's atmosphere. Traces of methane gas absorb the red wavelengths of light, leaving the green and blue wavelengths to be scattered back to us observers. Neptune is slightly bluer than Uranus. Recent cloud models explain why. To match the observations, the cloud deck at a depth of about 2 bars needs to be thicker on Uranus than on Neptune. Neptune's thinner cloud deck allows sunlight to penetrate deeper into its atmosphere before being reflected back out. This leads to more absorption by the red absorbing gaseous methane, and thus makes the planet bluer. Even prior to the 1989 Voyager 2 flyby, we knew Neptune had an active atmosphere. Throughout the 1980s, I spent many nights studying this distant world with the University of Hawaii's 2.2-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. The Hubble Space Telescope had not yet launched, and advanced methods to remove the distortion from Earth's atmosphere in images had not yet arrived on the astronomical scene. Even with the best telescopes on the planet, I could only rarely catch clear glimpses of Neptune's tiny disk when Earth's atmosphere was still and calm. Nevertheless, I could see bright features traversing the planet's disk as it rotated rapidly. Neptune takes 16 hours to make one rotation, so I expected a good show when Voyager 2 arrived. Even so, both I and others were stunned by the panoply of clouds, bands, and raging winds that Voyager revealed. On Earth, the atmosphere is primarily molecular nitrogen, while water is the weather wonder worker. Water's transformation through ice, liquid, and gas phases creates our myriad clouds, rain, and hail. Similarly, although Neptune's atmosphere is primarily hydrogen, methane acts as the primary condensable gas for the visible clouds. These clouds form at extremely cold temperatures, near 60 K, minus 213 degrees C, or minus 352 degrees Fahrenheit, at a pressure level in Neptune's skies of about 1 to 2 bars, which is similar to Earth's ambient surface pressure, 1 bar. In other words, the white puffy clouds are likely methane ice crystals that have condensed out of the methane gas in Neptune's atmosphere, much like Earth's white puffy clouds condense from water vapor in our warmer atmosphere. Newer models of the atmosphere include observations at near-infrared wavelengths, which scatter off high-altitude clouds. These models suggest that above the main visible cloud deck extends a thin aerosol haze, which reaches high up into the planet's stratosphere. This haze layer, unlike anything we see on Earth, is almost certainly due to photochemistry. Sunlight interacting with gases like methane creates other molecules composed of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, compounds such as ethane, acetylene, carbon monoxide, and diacetylene, all of which we've detected in trace amounts. If we could strip away Neptune's outer layers to see what lies underneath, we would find yet another, deeper layer of clouds. This layer extends down to a pressure of about 5 bars, the same pressure experienced at the depth limit of recreational scuba diving. We think this deep layer is made of clouds of hydrogen sulfide, H2S, as well as photochemical byproducts from the higher layers. These byproducts may rain down from above, or perhaps huge clouds in the deep layer punch upwards like thunderheads and then subside, dragging the compounds downward as they do. Hydrogen sulfide clouds would be consistent with radio wavelength measurements that probe to these depths, which suggest the presence of sulfur-bearing compounds. Giant dark storms. Neptune's dim color belies its remarkably dynamic atmosphere. The Voyager view in 1989 was dominated by a huge dark storm we unimaginatively called the Great Dark Spot. Voyager also revealed that the bright white clouds I had seen in the 1980s were companion clouds skirting the edges of this giant dark storm. My very first Neptune observations with Hubble's refurbished optics in 1994 were most exciting for what was missing. There was no hint at all of the huge dark spot that dominated the Voyager images. In just 5 short years, it had completely vanished. Subsequent Hubble observations over the past 30 years have revealed many more dark spots that appear and then vanish. The lifetimes range from 1 to 6 years. Small, bright white clouds often accompany the dark spots, floating at higher altitudes above the dark spot's edges. These clouds may form when atmospheric gases flow up and over the dark spot, where the methane in the gas can cool and condense into clouds. If the white clouds are methane clouds, what are the dark spots? Our highest resolution data come from Voyager's observations of the Great Dark Spot. That dark vortex seemed to be created by an absence of clouds, a wobbly gap in the two-bar cloud deck that revealed a deeper, darker layer. New models of more recent dark spots, however, link their appearance not to holes but to variations in the aerosols in that deeper 5-bar layer. We won't solve the mystery with current equipment. Hubble and the 10-meter Keck telescopes, along with NASA's infrared telescope facility, and large 8-meter telescopes, such as those at Gemini Observatory's two sites and the European Southern Observatory's Paranal Observatory, have all served as key tools for studying the ever-changing atmosphere of Neptune. Yet Neptune's disk is so small as seen from Earth that we are hard-pressed to even resolve these dark vortices, let alone to truly understand their details or dynamics. Thus, we are still unsure what is driving their remarkably changeable behavior. Finding the answers will have to wait for the upcoming generation of 30-meter telescopes, or a large space telescope that senses blue wavelengths, or perhaps even a future spacecraft mission to Neptune. In the meantime, observations with the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, will give us new insights into Neptune's atmosphere. JWST's first images of Neptune are spectacular and whetted our appetites, but the very best results, the spectroscopy, are yet to come. A primary objective of our JWST studies is to untangle the complex interplay among different layers in Neptune's atmosphere. The layers interact both chemically and dynamically. Compounds move up and down, mixing and creating new molecules or being destroyed, all while wind currents shuttle gas to and fro, and giant air cells rise and fall. In particular, JWST's ability to capture exquisite infrared spectra will enable us to study the composition and temperature variations of Neptune's atmosphere in unprecedented detail. Neptune and the Sun? Until today's modern telescopes began to probe more deeply, Neptune's tiny disk as seen from Earth prevented nearly all atmospheric details from being seen. Nevertheless, beginning in the 1950s, astronomers at Lowell Observatory dutifully recorded the overall brightness of the planet, year after year, decade after decade. In recent years, amateur astronomers have also recorded these brightness changes. The Lowell team noticed subtle changes in Neptune's brightness, which showed hints of being related to the planet's orbit around the Sun. Neptune's brightness steadily increased as it neared its solstice in 2005, but there also seemed to be a secondary signature imprinted on the data, and surprisingly, it seemed to be correlated with the Sun's 11-year activity cycle. Researchers suggested various solutions to this conundrum. The Sun emits significantly more ultraviolet radiation at the peak of its cycle than it does during solar minimum. This uptick in ultraviolet emission impacts the planet's atmospheres in various ways. Early on, some speculated that the variation in the Sun's output, even at distant Neptune, was somehow influencing the planet's upper tropospheric cloud cover. Others speculated that high-energy particles from the surrounding galaxy might be a more important driver. The Sun's magnetic field usually shields the solar system from these particles, but that shielding effect weakens along the field itself during the solar cycle's minimum. A fluctuating number of particles hitting Neptune's atmosphere could produce complex changes there. Yet another team of researchers suggested that solar maximum could lead to higher atmospheric temperatures, driving changes in a different way. More recently, a new team reanalyzed all of Hubble's data on Neptune, starting with mine in the early 1990s and continuing through to the present day. They found a strong correlation between the number of methane ice clouds and the solar cycle. As the Sun neared solar maximum, Neptune had more bright clouds. The team hypothesized that the Sun's increased ultraviolet output triggered the formation of more photochemical products, which could in turn seed cloud formation. More clouds then increased the overall planetary brightness by reflecting more sunlight, explaining why Neptune looks brighter when the Sun is most active. One thing that still puzzles us is how the feeble sunlight at Neptune's extreme distance could catalyze this change, since Neptune is 30 times farther from the Sun than Earth. This difference in distance would reduce what is blazing sunlight at Earth down to the light you might experience from an overhead office fixture. Perhaps all of the giant planets respond to the Sun this way, but the effect is swamped by the bright and dynamic cloud activity on Jupiter and Saturn, and masked by the extreme seasonal variability of Uranus. Maybe only distant, cold Neptune is stable enough for this faint effect to be discernible. This new study is probably not the last chapter in the story of Neptune's long-term variability, but it highlights the challenge of studying a planet whose seasons last for many decades. In my 39 years of studying Neptune, the planet still hasn't completed one full season. The first observations from Lowell Observatory were made when I was still in kindergarten, And some of the researchers doing the newest studies weren't even born yet when I was making the first Hubble observations of Neptune. The study of Neptune's atmosphere is by definition multi-generational. Neptune in the future. The many mysteries of Neptune's atmosphere continue to captivate me and my fellow planetary scientists. Why are its giant storms so short-lived? How can the feeble sunlight at Neptune's vast distance be driving atmospheric change? As described above, our current telescopes are chipping away at the planet's secrets, and soon, JWST observations will usher in a new era in our understanding. Neptune's secrets are crucial to today's burgeoning field of planetary science. With more than 5,000 exoplanets now known around nearby stars, we planetary scientists have a rich palette of planets to ponder. But to our surprise, the most populous class of planets seem to be one that is completely missing from our own solar system, worlds with sizes between those of Neptune and Earth. To truly understand planets and planet formation, we need to know what these planets and their atmospheres are like. With no planets within this size range to study in the local neighborhood, our local ground truth is limited to extrapolation upward from Earth or downward from Neptune. Looking ahead, I anticipate with keen interest the development of NASA's proposed Habitable Worlds Observatory. This telescope will be a super Hubble that will open a brand new chapter in Neptune exploration. It holds the promise of being able to deliver Voyager-quality images of Neptune's atmosphere anytime it looks at this blue world. Similarly, the new class of giant ground-based telescopes in development, which have mirrors measured in dozens of meters, may also reveal breathtaking details in Neptune's atmosphere. Someday, we will send a modern mission to the Neptunian system to do things that are beyond the capability of even today's finest telescopes. Such a mission could track the details of Neptune's variable clouds and perhaps even send a probe into the atmosphere. We learned so much with the Voyager 2 spacecraft, even though it was launched in 1977, with technology developed even earlier. Just imagine what a modern spacecraft might reveal with today's detectors and computational abilities. The one thing we know for sure is that, whenever we do finally send a spacecraft to Neptune, the ice giant will put on a remarkable show for us. I can't wait! Heidi B. Hamel is the Vice President for Science at the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy, which operates large telescopes for NASA and the U.S. National Science Foundation. What is twilight? Written by Gary Saronic. For night sky enthusiasts, twilight is a time of anticipation, a seemingly interminable interval between sunset and when it's dark enough to start productively using a telescope. But there's so much more to it than that. I'll bet even some experienced observers don't know that there are three types of twilight or fully appreciate how it unfolds in different parts of the world. Let's delve into the topic a little deeper. As with so much of astronomy, specific definitions apply to the condition we call twilight. The initial phase is known as sibyl twilight and is defined as the time between sunrise or sunset and when the center of the solar disk is as much as 6 degrees below the horizon. Typically, you'll only see the moon or Venus, assuming either is above the horizon during this period. When the sun is between 6 degrees and 12 degrees below the horizon, we experience nautical twilight. This is what most non-astronomers would simply refer to as nighttime. Towards the end of nautical twilight, it's dark enough that you need a flashlight to see what you're doing, and you can trace out most of the brighter constellations. Lastly, there is astronomical twilight, which occurs when the sun is 12 degrees to 18 degrees below the horizon. This is when the impatient among us uncover our scopes and start observing. It's not as dark as it can get, but it's still dark enough that planets and bright deep sky objects look pretty good in the eyepiece. And when the sun is more than 18 degrees below the horizon, we enjoy astronomical night. How long each phase of twilight lasts depends on your latitude. As a Canadian, I'm accustomed to long, lingering twilights. Indeed, from my home in southern British Columbia, astronomical twilight doesn't end at all for a few weeks around the summer solstice. The sun is never 18 degrees or more below the horizon. As a result, evening twilight merges seamlessly into morning twilight, skipping true night entirely. Yes, I can still use my telescope productively, but the observing window is very narrow. Indeed, it's not much of an accomplishment to pull an all-nighter during summer in southernmost Canada. Of course, things could be worse, too. The greater your latitude, the nearer you are to the land of the midnight sun. Locations north of the Arctic Circle or south of the Antarctic Circle don't experience any twilight around the summer solstice. The solar disk never slips below the horizon. Indeed, high-latitude spots are among the toughest places on the globe to be an amateur astronomer. For a good portion of the year, it doesn't get dark, and for the rest of the time, the weather is often terrible. Conversely, for those who enjoy the night sky from locations near the equator, the three phases of twilight pass in rapid succession. For example, if you travel to Costa Rica to drink in the night sky around the summer solstice, you'll find that astronomical night arrives just 70 minutes after sunset. That same day-to-night interval takes a full 150 minutes from mid-northern or 45 degrees latitude locations. Of course, this situation plays out south of the equator, too. These differences are governed by the angle of the ecliptic in relation to the horizon. Far from the equator, that angle is very shallow. As a result, from my home in Canada, it takes much longer for the sun to reach 18 degrees below the horizon so that night can begin. However, from the tropics, the sun seems to sink like a stone, following a path that's only a few degrees from being perfectly perpendicular to the horizon. It's time for Africa. Africa hosted the International Astronomical Union's General Assembly for the first time in August 2024. Written by Govert Schilling. If someone were to ask you which parts of the world are major players in professional astronomy, chances are that North America, Europe, and Eastern Asia, specifically Japan and China, would spring to mind first. Well, that has to change, according to Kevin Govender. Govender chaired the National Organizing Committee of the 32nd General Assembly of the International Astronomical Union, or IAU, which was held in Cape Town, South Africa, in August 2024. This has been a great opportunity to showcase to the world what we're capable of, he says. It's time for Africa. It was the first time in the IAU's 105-year history that the Triannual General Assembly was held on the African continent. During the opening and closing ceremonies at the Cape Town International Convention Center, more than 2,000 astronomers from 105 countries across the globe were treated to traditional Zulu warrior dances and performances by the Athemba Youth Choir. But most importantly, the numerous scientific symposia often highlighted important African contributions. Astronomy is not new to what was once pejoratively known as the Dark Continent. The Royal Observatory at the Cape of Good Hope, established in 1820, was the first modern scientific institution in Africa. It evolved into the current South African Astronomical Observatory. Since the start of the 21st century, several projects have called Africa home. Namibia hosts the Hess Gamma Ray Observatory. In 2005, the 9.2-meter effective aperture Southern African Large Telescope, the largest optical instrument in the Southern Hemisphere, received first light. And last July saw the construction of the first 15-meter dish of SCAMID, the mid-frequency part of the Square Kilometer Array Radio Observatory, which will incorporate the existing 64-dish Meerkat facility. But for most of its history, African astronomy projects were initiated, operated, and funded by foreign organizations, usually former colonizing countries. This has only started to change over the past decades, says South African astronomer and former trade unionist Bernie Fanaroff. For instance, local artisans are largely responsible for the construction of Meerkat and SCAMID, while government money has been invested to attract the best teachers to the high school in the nearby village of Carnarvon, where they train young people in science and technology. Fanaroff hopes and expects that other African countries will follow this example. With the abolishment of apartheid in 1994, South Africa became a fledgling democracy. Back then, the government issued a white paper on the desired approach to science and technology. Astronomy has been an essential part of that growth, says Govender. In a sense, the ambitions of 30 years ago have led up to the IAU General Assembly being held here. This conference is the culmination of the celebration of three decades of investment. Govender, who is also the director of the IAU's Office of Astronomy for Development, strongly believes that astronomy is the gateway to foster broader interest in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, among young children and high school students. That's why he made sure that each and every session of the IAU meeting was, and still is, freely accessible online, and why so many school visits were organized alongside the conference. To the astronomers, space scientists, and instrument builders who flocked into Cape Town in August, Africa has certainly been put on the map as a major player in the field. The IAU's next General Assemblies, in 2027 and 2030, will be held in Rome, Italy, and Santiago, Chile, respectively. But as Takalani Namangani, the Chief Director for Astronomy at the Department of Science and Innovation in South Africa, says, "I want to believe this is not the last time this event is coming to Africa, and it surely will no longer take another 100 years. Contributing editor Govert Schilling attended the IAU's 32nd General Assembly in Cape Town with the support from the VWN Trip Fund. If you want to learn more about Ayers Elaine, the types of programs we offer, follow us by clicking on any of the social media links at the top of our webpages. If you like what you see or hear, please click the like button. And that brings us to the end of today's podcast from Sky and Telescope. This podcast is for the sole use of our blind and print-impaired audience. Any unauthorized use is prohibited. I'm Roger Baker, and until next time, thanks for listening.